Accession number 28897, reel number 7.
This is the fourth reel of a taped interview with George Oliver in his home in Perth, Western Australia, on the 9th of the 2nd, 2006, for the Imperial War Museum in London, and the interviewer is John Bannister. George, I'd like for you, if you can, to tell us a little bit more about what was involved in going on your very first mission. And you were mentioning the place that you believed it was that you were to fly to.
Yes, it was near De Hesden, I think the place was called.
Do you know the date of it?
No, not off the top of my head. It would have been, well, I could find that out if you really wanted to know. But
roughly in...
It would be 1943,
yeah.
And it would be sometime before October, so I'd say probably the middle of 1943, sometime like that.
All right, well then, you're flying off, here we go, boys, we're off to
Yes, oh well, we just set course and so forth. That I remember being fairly settled down once we got airborne. As I say, any nerves I got usually were at the time of boarding or beforehand at briefing. I don't recall any problems getting over there. The navigator gave me the course to fly, and we'd already made the flight plan out on the ground. We always worked together on that, and I knew what speed I had to fly at and what height and what airspeed, and so I set my course. I've probably mentioned gyros, have I? The gyros that we used to steer on? We had these magnetic compasses, but the needle used to wobble quite a bit, and you had to sort of try and get it steady to see that you were exactly on course. And once you did that, we used to press the knob, or set the gyro to the same heading as what the compass was showing. And this was one of those gyros where they spin that quickly, you know, that they remain steady. We always used to then, once we'd set our gyro to the compass, then the compass could wobble around as much as it liked, and we just steered on the gyro until we changed course again. Then we went through the same procedure. And this would apply to all aeroplanes in those days. Once I got set on the course and everything, I just flew along, keeping a lookout for any interference. I don't really recall crossing the coast. It's a long time ago now, I don't recall very much flak. Well, there was a bit about, but it didn't hit us anyhow.
Well, describe to us your first experiences of being shot at. The flak and...
The flak. I didn't ever get into a really heavy barrage like some of the bomber boys did. There was always flak about when you crossed the coast as a rule and so forth, and then someone would have a poop at you along and you'd see these traces coming up and that type of thing. So I didn't like them very much. They always seemed to sort of curve in towards you and whatnot. But, it was just one of those things that you knew you had to do, you know. So I don't recall that there was a lot of flak that night. I can't really recall the details. But I know we were quite jubilant when we saw all these explosions on the ground, thinking we'd done the job. Mm. And I don't recall whether there was flak. There must have been some. They wouldn't have an ammunition dump unguarded and whatnot, I don't think. But At any rate, they didn't hit us. And my recollections of flak was usually the searchlights and the when it did come loose, it was a bit like fireworks night sort of thing, you know. It looked a bit like that from the distance. Yeah. Mm.
So your first mission was a supposed success. You mentioned your gunner saying that you'd been successful. The return trip, a safe, non-eventful?
Yes, no, it wasn't very eventful. As far as I can recall, it wasn't very eventful. We came back and landed, and then we had to go to debriefing and tell them whether we'd dropped it or not. I don't even recall whether we had cameras on board. I don't know whether you know this or not, or whether Ron mentioned it, but in Bomber Command and whatnot, they had cameras. When you dropped your bombs, the camera operated. So they could tell from the photographs whether you'd weaved around, tried to dodge the flak, or whether you went straight in, and whether you hit the target too. They got a pretty good idea from these cameras. So they could tell you whether you'd hit the target, but you didn't really know yourself. Although, of course, once the Pathfinder started to lay flares and whatnot, Pathfinder flares, well, the bomber boys just used to bomb on those, and they would know whether they'd hit those or not. But this one, there was no Pathfinders or anything like that. We just went in and bombed it, and because we saw all these explosions, we assumed that we'd hit the bomb. But I don't recall that we were ever told whether we did hit it very badly or not.
Following such an occasion, how did you sort of unwind? How did you bring yourself back to a reality?
Oh, well, we used to get a nice bit of bacon and eggs after an operation. And the padre, well, on the squadron anyhow, our padre was there. Whatever time he got back, he was always there to give you a bit of moral support. And we always used to look forward to our bacon and eggs. This was a real treat. And and then, of course, you were usually pretty well knackered by the time he got back. And so you went to bed, had a good sleep. And then if there was no flying for a while, well, the usual practice was to go and have a few beers or something like that, or go and see a girlfriend if you had one, or, you know, there were ways of winding down like that, keeping your mind off the job to some extent. You know, I know I might have mentioned before, I met Jean over there, and she's still with me here all these years. Had our 60th anniversary a little while ago, and so I used to think about my Jean a bit, you know, and
that's a sensible thing to do.
Yeah.
in relation to, and you've been mentioning this Wellington bombing raid, but in relation to the Stirling, what was the first operation that you went on in a Stirling? It's this special operation. What do you mean by that?
Well, have you heard of, Ron probably told you about Special Operations Executive, SOE, and SAS, Special Air Services. Special Air Services were being formed then, and SOE was, I don't know whether it was Churchill's idea, but he certainly supported it. And
what did you know of the SOE at the time?
Nothing. No. When we were sent down, when we got onto the squadron and were transferred into 38 Group, I've mentioned this before, I don't know, but 38 Group was a Royal Air Force group. It had been operating as a wing out in the Middle East, and it was designed or created specifically for airborne forces, and we used to call it the Airborne Forces Group. And This wing had been out in the Middle East dropping paratroopers and towing gliders. There were some very long gliders were towed right from England out to the Middle East and whatnot. And in the early part of the war, before we got into this sort of thing, so we joined 38 Group, and we went to a briefing after my first operation. Yes, that's right. That would have been. We went down to a place called Tarrant Rushton. We'd been doing quite a bit of general flying, lab testing, and testing aircraft, and going on cross countries. They always kept you busy, even if there wasn't any operating to do. And we went down to Tarrant Rushton, which is a place not too far from the coast at south coast of the UK. And I think it was quite an experimental sort of a place, because I've got a friend, or had a friend, who's passed on since, who was helping to build Hawser gliders, and they were made out of timber, and he was a timber airframes chap, and he was telling me that the Tarrant Rushton, he was an Englishman, and he'd been working on these Hawser gliders, making them, and he'd been at Tarrant Rushton too about the same time as me, but I didn't ever meet him because he was on the ground working on these things, and they were carrying out experiments, I think, how to get tanks and stuff out and in of these fuselages and all that sort of thing, and you know, whether a hole in the bottom of the floor might be better than a hole out the side and all that sort of thing in the to see how best to use these gliders. So I think there was a fair bit of experimentation might have been going on there. And so we were taken down to the called out of the briefing and put on the operations list, and they told us that our job that night was to take a load of supplies to a group in Europe. It was in France, somewhere over in the south of France. And so this is where we had our first briefing for a special duties trip. And some of it was similar to what you had for the bombing. The meteorological people gave a good talk down on what the weather was going to be like and what the winds would be like, hopefully, and whether the target would be clear when you got there. Then the gunner, the intelligence officer, would tell you what they knew about defences along the coast. Germans had mobile ones and had fixed ones along the coast, and they might suggest a couple of places where it would be a good place to cross. And then the gunnery officer would brief the gunners about whatever they had to know, and then, so far as I was concerned, the bomb aimer and the navigator used to get together. The navigators had their own briefing, and then they joined us after the initial briefing. They were the first ones to be told where we were going and everything. And we would make out a flight plan. The difference being that we could cross the coast. The point for crossing the coast could be of our own choosing. And so we used to choose a place to cross the coast. And we were the only people that knew what that spot was. And we used to go out one at a time. We didn't ever go out in groups. There were several flying, they all went off differently, probably to different dropping zones. And so you took off, and you were given a time to get there and drop this stuff. And it was a pretty short time frame. 10 minutes, quarter of an hour, or something like that. You'd supposed to drop these things within that time frame. And so once everybody had been briefed in their particular job, I better just mention this part of the briefing as far as the pilot, navigator and bomb aim are concerned. Our bomb aim, we had big scale maps for helping us to read our way along in moonlight, and we used to mark out our track on these maps so that we could just see where we were supposed to be. And my bomb aim and I used to pick out all the high ground for about 20 miles either side of the track, and we used to mark these in big letters on the map so that at any time he could just tell me what height the ground was underneath us, so I could keep a safe height and yet go as low as I could, you see, safely. And so we did that. That was one thing we did. And then they would all get in their position. And then once we'd selected the crossing point, our navigator, particularly our second navigator, Jimmy Oates, he devised a zigzag method for us to get across the water. And this is where flying low over the water comes in. And Ron mentioned that those lights business. Well, I didn't ever use that. But
these are the lights that have been used by the people. The
dam busters, yes. I didn't ever use those, but we didn't have to be quite as accurate as what the dam busters had to be, but our idea was to get low enough over the water so that we could get under the German radar. And he used to make an asymmetrical zigzag thing. And if the G-box, the old electronic G-box that we had, if that was functioning okay, that might get us across halfway across the channel or something. It might even get you right across the channel, but mostly about halfway, I think. That would help him too. And he'd just give me courses to steer, and we'd go across like this, zigzagging, you see, always heading towards the point on the coast, but not in a way where it could be predicted by watching our zigzags. And that seemed to work pretty well, because we didn't get any damage much on crossing the coast. And I'll just mention flying low over calm water at night is very difficult to judge your distance. And I don't know how the chaps that flew Sunderlands and whatnot got on. I suppose they got very used to it and so forth. But it was. And if you wanted to fly very close to the water. Anyway, I don't know how high we were flying, 100 feet maybe or something like that. A couple of hundred feet, I don't know from memory. But it was pretty low, you know. It was as low as I was going to go, put it that way. And get through there, and then I'd climb up a bit then and fly along about 1,000 feet. We could see more from 1,000 feet, and it also slowed down the speed the ground appeared to be going underneath you, and so it gave you more time to sort of spot anything that you wanted to cook. And so we used to try and keep on track all the while. And we had, at our briefing, we had decided to make what we called the main pinpoint. That was the main position that we were going to navigate to. It might have been a bend in a river or a marshalling yard or some prominent hill or anything like that. And we marked that on the map, and we actually navigated and map read our way to that. And then if we got there successfully, we knew where the people with the torch were, 10 or 15 miles in some direction, and the navigator had been finding the latest wind that we'd been using, and with that latest wind that he'd worked out, we would set a course for this, and I would have to fly at a certain airspeed, and a certain course as accurately as I could. And we did what they called a timed run. We figured out how long it would take us to get there at this particular airspeed. And so I just watched the watch, stopwatch, and when the time was up, 15, 20 minutes or whatever it was, I would circle around then. And sometimes when you got there, they saw you coming, the signal would come up as you were approaching. Other times, it might circle around for a while, and then the signal would come up. And other times, no signal came up. And then you had to cart all of the stuff back home again, if that happened. So that was about how we went. Is that making any sense to you?
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah. Yeah.
You mentioned that you didn't really know much about what was...
No. Okay, I'll get back to that then. They said to us, they said, now you're not to put anything in your logbook as to where you've going or been. So we said, well, what do we put? And they put, you just put ops's detailed. And that's all we were allowed to put, ops's detailed. Until after D-Day. Well, on our squadron, and I think some of them, other squadrons, mightn't have been quite as strict. But we didn't know why we were going. Well, we knew why. We were taking supplies to the underground, to the resistance movements, and that's all we knew. We'd never heard of Special Operations Executive. And it was only some time later that we were told, you can put SOE in there. And we thought, well, what the hell's SOE mean, you see? So we found out it was Special Operations Executive. And what this Special Operations Executive used to do was, through the BBC, they would send messages out in code to the resistance movements to say there was a drop at a certain time. And I don't know how the arrangements were made, but they were made through Special Operations Executive. And Special Operations Executive had been going for a while, and they trained people to be agents, wireless operators, and there'd been a couple of squadrons flying these little Lysanders and taking agents over and dropping them there. And there'd been a few parachuted in before we got involved in it. So by the time we got involved with it, about 5 months before D-Day, it was all being stepped up, and there were 10 squadrons in our group, and we were all doing these things. But we didn't know anything about Special Operations Executive at that time. And I've learnt more about it since the war than I knew then about that. But we gradually got the idea, because when we went to the briefing to pick up these agents and whatnot, there were people there, and we were introduced to these people, and they went out on the crew bus with us. So even though they didn't say much to us, we gleaned the fact that they belonged to some special organisation. And eventually, I think we discovered that this SOE meant Special Operations Executive. And then later on, SAS, there was some SAS that we went to too. And I suppose the British SAS was probably one of the first in the Allied. I don't know whether the Americans had that. I suppose they did. But anyway. No, we didn't know. We were just took these things out, and they were referred to as special operations against the enemy. That's the way they described them, special operations against the enemy.
So with these early trips, How are you experiencing this sort of flying? How are you feeling about it?
Well, it was a bit of an adventure too. We knew it was pretty risky, but wouldn't be any more risky, or mightn't have been as risky as bombing and whatnot, but there's always a risk there. But you've been trained for it, and you had a different mindset from what you've got in peacetime, and I admit to feeling a bit nervous at times, you know, and as I said before, I wasn't that keen on leaving about 10 or 11 o'clock at night and getting back about 5 or 6 o'clock in the morning, you know.
Chose a nicer time to...
Yeah, but I did...
9 and 5 during the day, probably.
Yeah, that's right. But I did decide, after I'd been doing it a bit, especially when we started to tow gliders and drop paratroops and whatnot, that I reckon it was one of the most interesting jobs in the Royal Air Force, and I still think that too. By the time we did our low-level trips into Europe like that, and of course we were young, and dropped these supplies from about 250 feet or so, and throwing these aircraft around doing that, you know, it's right up our alley really. And we enjoyed that side of it. So it was a mixture of nerves and excitement and so forth, I think. But it was interesting, very interesting. And then, of course, later on when we towed gliders, that was also done at Tarrant Rushton. One thing I might mention too while I'm about it is that on some of these early flights, we took pigeons out and dropped them. I was a bit surprised at the time to think they were using pigeons in World War II. And as a matter of fact, on one trip, one of the engines caught fire when we were starting it up, and so we had to abandon the aircraft and go to another one. They always had a spare loaded up ready in case something like that happened. And we had pigeons on at this time. At any rate, we hopped out of that aircraft, and US'd it, and we hopped out of that aircraft and went across and got in the other one and flew off, and we suddenly realised we'd left our pigeons behind. So I didn't get into any trouble over that. I often thought about it.